This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You will hear Australian scientist James Watson, who is influential globally. He gives us the bad news. On planet Earth, since the 1990s, we just lost 10% of the lands beyond us, the wilderness. The implications for climate and all living things is huge. Then Canadian author and teacher Peter Denton takes us deep into our role as possibilities in reality with his new book, Live Close to Home. I'm Alex. Let's get going with Radio EcoShock. We know humans are overrunning the natural world. We didn't know it was this bad. According to a new scientific study, since the 1990s, planet Earth has lost 10% of its wilderness. That bombshell work comes from a team led by Dr. James Watson. In Australia, he's an associate professor at the University of Queensland. Watson is also the director of the Science and Research Initiative at the Wildlife Conservation Society, and that's based in New York City. Plus, he leads or is part of a half dozen other global-scale initiatives on climate change and ecosystem science. He's published over 100 papers. Dr. James Watson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Why don't we start with the slippery term wilderness? How did you define that for this study?
Yeah, wilderness is a bit of a slippery term. We try to make it as simple as possible. We just mapped those areas on Earth that were not affected by large-scale infrastructure. That's things like mining or roads or industrial logging, as well as urbanisation, large-scale agriculture, and then joined those all together in a map and made that spatially consistent across Earth and looked at those areas that weren't affected by those activities. So to put it another way, we just looked at those areas on Earth that have still got either no populations of humans or very low populations of humans and where there was no visible evidence of large-scale modification.
I'm almost surprised that you could find any places like that.
Oh, look, the Earth is large. You know, there's many places that we know there's very low populations across the Earth. And we found that there's still around 25% that is largely unaffected by large-scale human activities. But what was scary, and as you alluded to at the start, is that we've lost a significant amount, 3 million square kilometres of those areas in just over 20 years. Now, that's an area twice the size of Alaska, or half the size of Australia, gone in 20 years. And that's quite alarming, considering that once you lose these areas, you never get them back. You can't restore a wilderness area. You can't offset it. Once they are degraded, they'll return to something else. And that's a real concern when you think about conservation of biodiversity, when you can think about climate change.
So where are the biggest areas of diminishing wilderness?
Look, the area that was most affected was the Amazon. We found 30% of the Amazon has been lost in the last 20 years, which is an alarming rate. And it's scary because it's been often talked about as a good news story. There's been some very progressive policies made by governments that contained the Amazon around stopping deforestation during that time period. But the satellites don't lie. What we show is that literally one-third of all wilderness areas in Amazon was lost in just over 20 years. Central African forests lost a lot as well. There's about 15% of those forests that were lost. But there was degradation everywhere. You know, like in Australia, we lost a lot of the northern savannas, which are the great tropical woodlands that occur across our north. They have been degraded considerably. In Southeast Asia, there's very little wilderness left, simply because of the amount of population pressure there, but even the spots that you would expect to see wilderness have been declining dramatically. Those areas in Borneo and in Burma and in Indonesia, you see some massive decline there as well.
And I noticed you looked at Siberia as well. Why?
Oh, look, it's anywhere that is not untouched. So, you know, all ecosystems are equal, you know, in terms of regardless of how many species they hold or how productive they are, they all are important. They've had long evolutionary histories and they should be considered equal. So we look at every ecosystem on the terrestrial surface. And, you know, the boreal forests and the tundra are doing quite well when you've looked at the pressures that we looked at. Sadly, though, the one pressure we couldn't map was climate change. You know, And if you put that into the equation, I'm sure that those high-latitude ecosystems and those high-mountain ecosystems would be very affected.
Okay, so beyond the biology, you have expertise in climate change. Is there a direct relationship between a changing climate and loss of wilderness?
Look, there's definitely evidence, significant evidence, of climate change impacting ecological processes around the world. You know, and what that we're seeing is that those ecological processes are being altered, and that is therefore affecting the very functioning of some of these intact ecosystems. So where I'm from in Australia, what we see time and time again is a drying system, you know, because of global warming, means that there's far more fire-prone activity occurring, you know, across ecosystems that rarely experience fire. So in Tasmania, the island in the southern part of the continent of Australia, and it's, you know, considered one of the most beautiful areas on Earth, areas of wilderness there have burnt for the first time in its evolutionary history, and they've burnt so considerably that they'll never come back. And we're not talking small areas, we're talking thousands and thousands of square kilometres of area was lost because of a fire event that occurred because it was so dry that when a match was lit, it actually burnt a system that should be moist and be able to buffer a fire, and we've lost that system. So climate change is having a real impact, and it's having varying impacts across a lot of ecosystems around the world.
Can we take the reverse position and say the decline of wilderness makes climate change worse, operating like a positive feedback?
It's 100% of positive feedback. What we show is that some of these ecosystems store huge amounts of carbon. The boreal forest in North America contains some astronomical amount of soil carbon and carbon in the woody debris. Now, when you erode those systems or when you degrade them, what is shown is that at least 50% of the carbon that was in that system is released back in the atmosphere. So you're seeing a massive land use impact on climate change. And our fear is this has been underreported at the moment. What we know is that nations report back on their land use as part of their agreements to the United Nations Framework for Climate Change, and they don't consistently do that. So we believe that a lot of ecosystem degradation isn't really caught up in the carbon accounts that nations report, and therefore we're underestimating the actual real impact to the atmosphere when it comes to carbon concentrations. Wilderness areas in particular, because they're so carbon dense, especially these boreal forests and these tropical rainforests, when they degrade, a lot of carbon is released. And I just think that it's underreported, and as you say, a massive positive feedback loop when it comes to climate change.
Now, you mentioned satellites. How did your team actually pick up a picture of what's happening with wilderness? What's the technique behind this?
So we used a number of techniques to try and understand our human pressure on Earth. You know, we used satellite images, and that was able to detect things like night lights, like urbanisation, like large-scale agricultural change. But we combined that with mapping activities that looked at roads, looked at population densities, looked at pasture lands. So we're able to use bottom-up techniques and also top-down techniques that have come from satellites to really come to this spatially consistent map of where we thought pressure was on Earth. Now, this process of actually joining all this data together is incredibly complicated. And it's one of the reasons why we don't often get these kind of updated human footprint maps is because it's really technically very hard. But when you get a product like this, you can actually start assessing things over time. How has the human footprint changed across space and time? And that's the power of our research. Obviously, as data gets better, as satellite data gets better, road data gets better, human population data gets better, we'd like it to feed into this and make it iterative so the maps get better and better. So we've decided to make all our data open access, and that we've got a platform that people can look at and actually add data to, so that we can actually get a better picture over time as the human pressure changes across Earth.
I guess eventually that'll be available in real time to all of us. We can really see what's happening on our planet.
Look, I think what would be exciting is that, you know, every time we watch the news, we look at the stock exchange working in real time. You know, every time you watch the news, you see scores of your favourite sports teams every weekend, you know, buzzing across the bottom of the television set. What I'd love to happen is that an indicator like this is actually reported on nightly thing just right next to the weather or right next to the stock exchange saying, and this is how the human environment's going, and this is how climate change is going. so that we can actually have real-time updates on what's going on and make it just a common conversation about our state of play in the world.
You know, we talked about climate as a driver of wilderness loss, but I think most of us picture it as economic exploitation, whether it's multinational corporations or just poor people desperate for an income or a place to grow food. How do you assess that driver?
In terms of economic growth?
Yeah. I mean, is that the primary cause of loss of wilderness, or is it other things?
Look, there's two fundamental drivers, I think, and to be really frank, the first is population growth. Like, our population is, you know, getting out of control in some cases, and it's not going to calm down for a while yet. You know, a lot of people predict that the world's population is probably going to get stabilised at about 12 billion people. It's rapid population growth that is, and the consumption of goods by humans is causing a lot of environmental harm. That is one factor that, you know, that is a serious driver of every problem we face on Earth, if you look at it. The second driver, of course, is nations really trying to achieve this standard of economic sustained growth, and they mark how they're doing in the world in terms of how well our economies are growing. Now, it's unsustainable to have economic growth, at high rates all the time. That is just, any economist worth their salt will say it's actually an impossible thing to keep on going. But as you drive economic growth and you're driving consumption, and on top of it is population growth, it's one of the reasons why, the natural resources of the world are being massively depleted.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. James Watson. He's with the University of Queensland in Australia and the Wildlife Conservation Society. He's brought out an important piece of science on wilderness with the title, Catastrophic Declines in Wilderness Areas Undermine Global Environmental Targets. I want to ask you, is there a tipping point or a biominimum when we've lost too much wilderness to continue evolution on this planet, or would we even know if we crossed such a threshold?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. Everyone asks me, when I do media or when I, even in scientific workshops and conferences, how much does nature need? What is, is a bare minimum? And the only thing I can say to, as a fair response is that we know what nature needs. Nature needs 100%. That's how evolution worked. Nature sustained itself and actually underwent unbelievable ecological and evolutionary processes to see, to come up with the systems that we see around us today because they had 100%. Now we've degraded the Earth considerably over the last 300 or so years since the Industrial Revolution. And we know that almost every ecosystem on Earth is now being massively degraded to much smaller extents. Now, I think some biomes still have enough nature in them that is functioning that to sustain something that what we used to have before humans dominated the Earth. Whether it's enough to actually sustain whole wide-scale evolutionary processes, it's hard to tell. But, some systems like the tundra, and the boreal forests in the northern latitudes, they are still fairly large and fairly extensive. But the other side of the coin is we know that certain ecosystems have been completely smashed. Mediterranean ecosystems, lowland rainforest ecosystems, mangrove ecosystems, seagrass ecosystems. We know that they have been so dramatically modified. We're talking about 99% modification here. That the chances of those systems being able to go through natural evolutionary processes that that would have happened before humans touched them is not going to happen. That's absolutely unrealistic. Now, there will be evolution in all these systems. Evolution is a continual process, and that and when you have major disruptions such as an asteroid strike or a major natural climate change event, you do see disruptions, which actually causes great numbers of speciation. It's actually a big circuit breaker when you think about evolution. The difference, though, between what happens naturally over geologic time scales and what we're seeing on the Earth now is that we're giving nature a good series of stresses at the same time, which will definitely impede that ability to bounce back, nature's ability to undergo evolution. So when you clear most of the habitat and then you force a massive climate change event on top of species, their resilience is so much reduced that the chances of a evolutionary response in a short time scale is going to be unlikely across many of these systems.
Now, one thing that worries me a little bit about your study is that we're taking the 1990s as a starting point because that's when reliable satellite mapping becomes available, I presume. But, of course, we've talked with biologists who say Earth lost important wilderness long before that. Is there a reliable benchmark for the state of the wild, and are we in danger of everybody comparing things to the beginning of satellites when we should be taking a broader time scale?
Oh, yeah, look, I think that's a fair criticism, but, I mean, just maybe to push back a little bit, we know what the benchmark was. Before humans, it was 100%. Like, so, you know, in 1993, we had about 28% of the world that was wilderness, and now in 2016, there was 25% of the world is wilderness. So we are going from the benchmark of 100% to, you know, down to 25% and below. So I think... you know, you're right that we shouldn't just say that 1993 is when it all started. I think the reality and what we try to make the case in the science is that we started from a very, very bad position already and it got worse. And what is scary about these findings is that there's diminishing areas left. You know, the green spaces on Earth are retracting to the cold places of the Earth and the dry places of the Earth, the deserts and the Arctic and the Antarctic and the high mountains. That's where our wilderness is retracting to, but it's still retracting. It's not slowing down. Even if you've got less and less area available, we're not seeing a slowing down. So our fingerprint, our footprint is actually still expanding, despite the fact that you get so much retreated to areas that are not very hospitable to humans. That's a scary finding, and it begs the question, well, when will it stop? Now, how much wilderness will be there in 50 years' time? Where will it be located? And our findings show that, you know, there might be not much left, which is incredibly sad for our children and their children, and also for the planet.
So what do you think? Can a human civilization continue on a planet without wilderness?
Of course it can. You know, humans are incredibly technically efficient and able to, you know, to live in, that's the thing about humans, they're able to live anywhere under almost any circumstance. They are incredible at adapting to change. But whether it's going to be a nice place to live, whether, you know, it begs the better question. You know, I think that humans are causing so much damage to Earth right now. I mean, we're going to be losing considerable number of our ecosystems and the species that sustain them. And I'm talking about 50 to 80% of these species around us won't be there in 50 to 100 years' time. Now, will humans still be here? I'm betting they will. You know, I think unless there's a catastrophic event like a world war or a nuclear strike, we'll be around. But what kind of life will it be without any coral reefs? What kind of life will it be, you know, 5 degrees warmer, daily average temperature? What kind of life will it be, you know, when there will be no green spaces to go walk in and actually just listen to bird sound and listen and see wild animals doing incredible things? I think it's going to be a very sad day that when we have to rely on David Attenborough and just look at the television to get all that kind of thrill around seeing nature and really reflect that, you know, those species and those places just don't exist anymore.
Well, that's the finale in the sci-fi movie Soylent Green. When people were passing on, they got to see films of what nature was like and a terrible state. So let's move from that. Is there any hope we can turn this destruction around, James Watson? And if so, how?
Look, I think definitely. I think there's definite hope. I think it's, you know, and it starts with leadership. You know, it starts with leadership at national scales, which could then change international way of thinking about things. So there are a lot of nations that contain large-scale wilderness areas that are developed, that are democratically elected, and that with the right push and the right leadership can save them. Now, Australia is one of them. The US is another. Canada is another. Brazil is another. These countries, if they just combine their leadership and they've gone, you know what? These last intact places, which are so important as reference points for what nature looks like without humans being there, are very, very important. And we are going to proactively stop their degradation by stopping bad activities that are aimed at economic growth but are bad for the environment in them. So we can easily sustain that kind of law. And those nations can actually then work together, actually say, look, we've saved our wildernesses, and then set up some mechanisms to allow those developing nations that need to utilise their natural resources to actually set up some financial mechanisms to reward them for keeping their intact systems intact and trying to develop through other means. Now, I think that is very doable. We still have a lot of large intact places left, but the trick is to act quickly and, as I say, act as a global community with leadership from those developed nations who are willing to actually offset some of their financial growth to ensure that their natural systems are still in place in the future. So I think there is hope. I think, you know, the truth is, I think with climate change in particular now really resonating around a lot of people, that this action is going to be coming soon. You know, I think that, you know, I think people are not going to tolerate a world of 2 degrees, let alone 5 degrees. What I hope is that other environmental outcomes will come about if we all act together. And one of those environmental outcomes, I think, should be preserving the last intact ecosystems on Earth as part of the, you know, the outcome that we want Earth to have as we go through these kind of major dilemma points that we're facing right now.
But I have to be frank, I didn't hear that dialogue coming out of the Paris Climate Agreement talking about wilderness preservation.
So this is the reason why we wrote this paper. That's exactly because that was largely missing. And that doesn't mean that that conversation's over forever. It means that we've got to actually raise awareness around the issue and make sure it actually enters into the next bit of dialogue. You know, so one of the things that we hope from writing this paper is just to make the point to policymakers, to leaders, saying you've forgotten something. You've forgotten something quite substantial, and that is these ecosystems, these large intact ecosystems, play a substantial role in combating climate change, in combating species extinction. They're incredibly important for hundreds of millions of the most marginalised people on the earth. Now let's put them into the treaty and really account for them and set targets around them. Yeah, so we raised the issue and we're now hoping to engage with policymakers to ensure that that's in the next text around the UNFCCC, the Convention for Biological Diversity, and other conventions such as the Sustainable Development Goals.
Now, I have to admit, I get a little confused about some of the wilderness protection groups. Could you tell us just briefly, what is the Wildlife Conservation Society and what's your role there?
So the Wildlife Conservation Society is, you know, one of the largest conservation non-government organisations in the world. You know, it works in around 60 countries, in around 75 landscapes and seascapes, and it has a very clear vision of saving wild species and wild places. So it really does, at its core, really have this idea of thinking through that intact ecosystems are important and that maintaining those species that need them. So that's elephant species, rhinoceros species, tigers, lions, leopards. Those species need these large spaces. So trying to keep these kind of faunal assemblages intact in these systems. And as I say, we work in a lot of countries. Now, my role in that group, in the organisation, is to direct the science and research initiative. So this is to try and do cross-cutting science that influences global policy, but at the same time shares lessons across landscapes and seascapes. So I spend a lot of time travelling around the world talking with country directors and landscape directors about what challenges they face and what are the best types of science we can do to solve the challenges that, you know, that they're actually experiencing. And if there's lessons that can be learnt from other parts of the world, can actually work in their landscapes and seascapes.
Have you had that conversation in China of your advising what they can do to preserve what they've got left?
Oh, look, so WHS has a strong China office. I've not been there. My focus has been a lot in Africa and Asia and Latin America to some degree. What we do in China is work a lot on policy around on ivory trade and such like. So I haven't actually been there. I mean, one landscape we do have in China, which is amazing, is in Tibet. So, you know, it's one of the largest intact systems on the planet in the highlands of Tibet. And we've been working with local and federal governments there to try and keep that system in place. And from all reports, I've never been there, but all reports, it's been going fantastically well. So there's been fantastic efforts done by the government and by the local community to actually keep these systems in place.
Well, I don't want to keep you too long, but just out of curiosity, what is the Green Fire Science Group?
So that's my lab at the University of Queensland. So I have a research lab of 10 PhD students and 4 postdoctoral researchers. They are we're really focusing on applied research. I don't want to be a research lab that actually just writes papers for the sake of writing papers. So all my students are dedicated to ensuring their science actually is applied at either the local scale or the global scale. And so right now I have a PhD student in Indonesia working with the WCS program there. I have another program in Mozambique working with the local government there doing land use planning. Another student's actually supporting the Cambodia government. So the Green Forest Science Group is to try and, you know, to get researchers and practitioners joined together focused on applied conservation science that can get to outcomes. So if your listeners are interested, just go Google greenforestscience.com and have a look at the website. And please send me an email. I'd love to hear their thoughts.
Well, I'll be putting some links to the science and the groups we've discussed in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. From Australia, we've been talking with Dr. James Watson. I think he's an important sort of hybrid scientist who bridges not just climate change, but the relationships between climate and the natural world, or at least what's left of the wilderness, and that's what his new paper is about. James Watson, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In 2006, I recorded a speech in a church by British writer George Monbiot. George was touring for his climate book, Heat. He said that love miles might do us in. He meant the distances covered by so many of us, especially in airplanes, simply to see family members. George suggested we return to the older practice of marrying people who live close to us. It seemed shocking at the time. But it goes much deeper than that, from food miles to product shipping. Our next guest says we must all learn four new words as the mantra for our lives, live close to home. That's the title of a new book by Canadian author and scholar Peter Denton. Peter's an odd mixture. He teaches soldiers about religion and war at the Royal Military College of Canada. He's an ordained minister of the United Church. Dr. Denton holds 5 degrees. He's one of 2 regional representatives for the North American stakeholders at the United Nations Environment Program, or UNEP. Denton writes seamlessly on military theory like battle space, about the essence and impact of technology, and the role of ethics in our survival. His newest book is about something all of us can do, really must do, to swing away from catastrophic emissions of greenhouse gases. From St. Andrews, Manitoba, Peter Denton, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much.
We have lots to talk about, but first, how would you introduce your new book to our audience?
In part, what I would say is it's the third in a series, and there are 3 different facets of my response to the questions around how we got here from there, and how do we move forward into whatever future we choose. I think the key element here is choice. It's a recognition that our current situation is not the product of some divine plan. It's not the product of some universal necessity. It's the specific product of choices that people have made up to this point in time. And that whatever future we have is a consequence of the choices that we are going to make and are making ourselves today. So the question is, what kind of choices and to what end? And in this particular book, I realized that one of the key facets of our society, something that has spun up really since the 17th century, has been our fixation with life at a distance. That more than any civilization in history, we have found ways of being able to be elsewhere in terms of how we live. Not only is our food from somewhere else, our money is something that happens in the future because we're all living on credit. We don't marry that girl next door. We actually are far more interested in people thousands of miles away through the internet than anyone we actually can walk up to and talk to. So all of these things in combination have created a society in which what's near at hand is not nearly as interesting or valued or important as something far away. And when you start putting all of those pieces together, you pretty quickly come to realize the fragility of the situation in terms of our ability to continue in this fashion and the ways in which we need to regain control over what happens in our lives. And that ability to regain control focuses on what we actually can reach. So, you know, we can go hungry if we can't reach food with our own hands, with our own arms. So it's the realization that the only place in the world that we actually have control over is right close to home.
You know, a few months ago, a casual acquaintance raved about a big family wedding, I remember, and the bride and the groom and all 50 guests flew to Tahiti for a fabulous wedcation, let's say. And, you know, Peter, I almost gave up hope for our species. Why is this so wrong?
Well, it's a really good question, because we talk about ecotourism, for example, as a way to respond to the excesses of long-distance travel. I think ecotourism is essentially an oxymoron, because when you look at the environmental impact of tourists all around the planet, it's catastrophic. And yet we somehow excuse that because it's a family wedding, or we really must see that person again, or I've always wanted to, you know, scale the side of that volcano. And our efforts at home to live a more sustainable lifestyle seem to go straight out the window the moment we utter the word vacation.
Yeah, but you know, I have to admit, I've traveled the world just to see it, and only later did I learn the damage that I added to nature. Can we tell the next generation, Peter, don't do as we did?
Well, I think that often is the case. One generation tries to explain that to the next. No, don't make the same mistakes we did. I'm not sure how successful that ever is. I think this is one of the places where there needs to be a partnership and the realization together that it's not as simple as dividing this generation from the next generation, because we are all in this situation together. If you think of it in the context of how rapidly we have to make significant changes to how we live together, we're not talking 25, 30, 50 years. We're talking 5 years. And that means that someone who's 90 is as much a part of what's going on as someone who's 10. And I think that realization of us all being in this situation together, that, as I like to say, in a round world, there is no place to hide. There's no corners you can hide in. There's no place to escape, that it affects all of us. So it's a social reversal. I think we're looking at a social and cultural reversal of all generations, because some of the most wasteful people I know are the younger ones.
As you say, it does take time, though. It took my wife and I 10 years to get out of the city. It took a lot of planning, and we had to figure out how we were going to live and all that sort of thing to get to a village in a food-producing area. Now we can walk to pretty well everything we need. I think that's the sort of direction that you're writing about, is it?
Yes, it is. Although one of the realizations, I think, is that not everybody has that opportunity or the options that you might have had. And I found that certainly as I have traveled and seen people in other parts of the world and the extent to which they have so little. I've been up in the hills of Kenya with a Maasai community that I've become involved with. And when I see how little they have in comparison to what even poor people have in North America, it makes you realize that when we talk about sustainable development, we have to live with a great deal less, but they need to live with more so that they can live at all. So it's a balancing of that global equation that I think we need to look toward, along with the realization is that no one can step outside the game. So it'd be really nice if we could say that if we could only all go back to living in a natural state, the world would be a better place. But we can't. And there is no place we can hide from the consequences of human activity. What it really amounts to is how can we make a better choice today than we did yesterday? And while that seems incredibly futile and minuscule, maybe, it's really the only answer that we have that makes any sense. Because the situation we are in at the moment is the consequence of many billions of small individual choices that have created the mess. And the answer that we have is to reverse that same curve by making those same billions of small choices in a more sustainable direction. And when you start multiplying choices by the numbers of people who are making them, we do have the possibility of reversing course just as dramatically as we have embarked on one that has led to the destruction of the planet. So it may seem like small potatoes to, say, make better choices today than yesterday, but it really is something that you have control over. You don't have choices about tomorrow. Tomorrow never happens. But when we consider what things we did yesterday and the impact that they had on other people and on the planet and resolve to do something different today, then it's really quite extraordinary to see how quickly that sea change can happen in a reverse direction.
So it's taken you, Peter Denton, three books to explore how we might move towards sustainability and what it means. Let's start with your 2012 book, Gift Ecology, Reimagining a Sustainable World. What is that about?
Well, that was the first piece, and I'm an historian at heart, and I asked the question, what is it about our society that has led us to this unsustainable circumstance? And so I identified one key concept, the reality that we have increasingly lived in a world where things are valued and measured in linear mechanical terms that we can count, slice, and dice and pay for. And realizing that the mechanics of that exchange relationship and the linear mechanical systems that it involves created the problem, I asked myself, well, if this is a product of choices, where were the choices made and what was the alternative? And that was when I realized that the alternative to the mechanics of exchange has always been the gift. And it's a hard thing to identify in a historical context because even the examples out on the West Coast there of Aboriginal societies that valued gift-giving in very highly and organized potlatches and activities around that actually developed those activities post-contact. And then if you consider before what we have always done as humans, what we have valued as humans, we valued relationship, we valued beauty, we valued truth. We value those things which cannot be bought and paid for, that cannot be sliced and diced. We value the gift. And when you start looking at oppositions, the opposition between gift and exchange, I mean, a gift is something that can never be reciprocated, that can never be responded to except by accepting it. It's not like Christmas presents, right, where you give me something good and I give you something better. It's like the gift of life you get from your mother. How can that ever be repaid? Or the gift of friendship. You can be a friend in return, but it's not the same thing as an exchange where you've given me $5 and I've given you, you know, a hamburger or something.
And so true. And I value just sometimes sunsets and things like that, and they have no monetary value.
Exactly.
Now, you say that we cannot tweak the current system to make it sustainable, and I certainly believe that. We have to change the game. How did that work out in your 2014 book, the next in the series, Technology and Sustainability?
Well, continuing on that same question, right? How did we get here from there, and then what do we do about it? So in Technology and Sustainability, I asked the question off the bat that I used to ask my students in the course that I taught on this, whether they'd made an ethical choice today. And if so, what it was. The best answer I ever got was one guy who put up his hand rather hesitantly. And when I asked him what his choice was, he said, I'm not sure. I know I must have made a choice today, but I just don't know what it was. So it occurred to me in that kind of a situation that we sort of have two parts to the problem. One, we have a world in which people make choices every day without thinking about them. And that explains a lot, because I always ask myself, why is it that perfectly intelligent, reasonable, educated, compassionate, nice people could make consistently self-destructive and stupid decisions? What's going on? And I thought, well, they're making those decisions that way because they're not thinking about them. That's half the problem. And then I got thinking a little further, and I said, wait a minute, what are they making those decisions about? And it occurred to me that they were making those decisions about a technology they didn't understand. We live in what is supposed to be the technological society, but when I sat down the first time I ever did this course to come up with a definition of technology, everyone I came up with exploded on me, and then I finally realized that I didn't know what technology was. But that was okay, because neither did anybody else.
Oh, we know what it is. It's computers. It's a smartphone.
Yeah.
It's a jet plane.
Yeah, precisely. It's objects. It's things that we can plug in or we can kick.
Yeah.
And yet, it's not. technology is what makes us human. It goes back to the very dawn of human civilization, because it's not in our hands, it's in our heads. What I really wanted to call that book was Technology is in Our Heads, but that one didn't get past the editorial board. Really, what it means is that technology is instrumental knowledge, or knowledge we use to do something. And if you see it in that perspective, every civilization has had the technology it needed to survive, because it's the product of the choices that people make. It's not accidental. There's no such thing as value-neutral technology. It's the product of choices that people make. And when they're thinking, they make those choices for reasons, and those reasons reflect their values or what they think is important. So we can literally reverse engineer any piece of technology, any system, right back to the values that drove the decisions to create it and to use it. And if you don't like what you find when you do that reverse engineering and go back to the values that underlie something, well, then you change the values. But once you change the values, you change the reasons, the choices, and the technologies. And when you put those things in a row, it not only pushes you to think first in the Gift Ecology book about the fact that we're making choices, we need to open up the possibilities of the gift that are unleashed on the world where something completely unexpected is given to somebody else. But then the process for how to make those choices, how to live, involves intentional, thoughtful decisions that are based upon the values that we think are important.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Peter Denton. We're talking about his new book, Live Close to Home. Now, in your most recent book of the three, Live Close to Home, you examine six threads on this pathway to sustainability. Could you briefly tell us what those are, and then we'll dig into a couple of them, maybe?
The first pathway is actually the one that I thought was in some ways the most fun. It's all about food. So if you're looking for a really close-to-home example of the problems of an unsustainable civilization, literally, I think that the line that I like to use in it is that we need to learn to eat with a shorter spoon. Look at the distance to which our food travels, where it comes from, the fact that people no longer know how to grow it, that when they do find the food, they no longer know how to cook it, and you realize the extent to which our society everywhere is food insecure. We're used to thinking of people on the other side of the world who don't have water, who don't have access to seeds, who are in the midst of conflict situations. They're food insecure, but we're not. And yet, when you look at our system itself, if you're not able to walk to the market and find the food there that's grown locally, then it's coming in at a distance, and often an extraordinary distance, because we no longer rely on what's close by for our staple foods. So that's the first and most obvious piece, that even the food we eat is not something we actually have control over, because we don't grow it. And even if we're able to get our hands on it from somewhere else, we don't know what to do with it when we get it. And so you can see the consequences for malnutrition, the consequences for obesity. And generally, a state of ill health, even in an area where at least we would like to consider ourselves to be wealthy and food secure. But following from that is the second piece. It's the realization that we also don't have control over knowledge that is close to hand either. We are constantly pulling Google out and trying to learn something from Google. But all knowledge in the past, if you think of it in terms of technology, involved some degree or some significant degree of physical activity, of action over things in your immediate surroundings, your immediate circumstance. It's not just intellectual. It's not at a distance. It's something you have to learn how to swing that hammer. How do you learn? Well, it's physical, using your muscles, hand-to-eye coordination. And following from the problem that we don't know what to do with our food, the realization I came to was that we are actually hemorrhaging useful knowledge at a rate that is positively staggering from generation to generation. So much of that basic knowledge of the basic technologies that we've developed over thousands of years with how to survive is passed down orally from generation to generation. And all you need to do is, in an oral culture, is to disrupt that flow of information by one generation, and you've essentially lost most of what people know. And in Canada, you can certainly see that in the context of Aboriginal culture and the residential schools situation, where people or children were taken from their families, taken from their communities, told they couldn't speak their language, not allowed to follow their customs, and were given something else instead. And we can identify that, we can see that from outside and recognize it for the kind of culture crime that it was. But at the same time, we're doing exactly the same kind of thing when it comes to the sorts of information and technologies that have been passed down. You know, whether you're German or Polish or Ukrainian or whatever, there was a whole series of things that your great-grandparents used to know that you simply don't anymore.
That's so true. And I'm trying to recapture some of that, and the people that I know are trying to recapture some of that. And it does go back to food in a way, too, you know, how to preserve it, how to can it, how to make things and really be able to eat later. So you've got other items on your list. You've got reality, community, economy, ecology. Can we have a local economy? Are you pushing that as well?
Again, if we're looking for what it is we have control over, economy is one of those things. And if you look at the origins of agricultural economy, it always came out of surplus agriculture. We're not even growing our own food, but in the past, you know, the origins of civilization, as you move past the subsistence level, whatever you grew was something that then was traded to somebody who had something he wanted. And that was the origins of the early economics. And in that instance, we have control over what we have created. We have control over who gets it. When we give it away or when we exchange it, we have some expectation of a return. But instead, what we have with this society that is constantly living at a distance is a series of presumptions around the nature of the economy and our economics that's kind of like a giant Ponzi scheme, because the assumption is that somehow we have control over what's going to happen tomorrow. And I continue to share some of the concerns that people have around what happens when investors don't believe it anymore. What happens when you realize that all that money you've been socking away into your retirement savings plan is kind of pointless, because by the time you get there, the economy that you've invested in is going to implode. We assume that tomorrow is going to be there. We're told Freedom 55 is the answer, and we're supposed to invest for that rosy future and to see ads on TV where everyone's sort of sitting around on their Caribbean island sipping rum punches. And yet, that is so far from the reality that is rapidly approaching us that it's frightening. I've had students in class where I've asked them to sort of think about what they thought the world would look like in 2050. And we get the whole series of environmental catastrophes unfolding and all of the lines that we can see. And then I say, okay, now tell me what your life's going to be like in 2050. And they've just been paralyzed, because they've got it all planned out with sort of the spouse, the dog, the three kids, the house in the burbs, and the fancy vacations in Tahiti, or maybe a destination wedding or two. And they realize that those two realities simply cannot coexist. And so that's really where the origins of all of those books have come from, is that we are constantly confronted by this dichotomy between denial and despair. Either everything's just hunky-dory, there's no problem, keep on going the way we always have done, living in la-la land, or complete despair when we crunch all the numbers and realize that there's no way out of the trap that we're in. And so most of us are kind of in the middle there. We'd really rather live in la-la land, and we're afraid we might live in disaster land, but we still have to go through day by day and live toward the future. And I think that's where the discussion around possibility comes back into the picture, because in a linear system, you can predict what is going to come next. That's the point of a linear system. But you can only predict it if you understand all the elements of the system. Otherwise, it's like trying to guess the weather. You know, on the prairies, we can't even manage to get the weather straight 6 hours out, despite the fact you could send somebody up a tall building with a pair of binoculars and have a good look. So when it comes to complicated climate systems, I mean, any predictions of any significance are really kind of laughable. And so we feel trapped. The only tools we have are these predictive tools for mechanical linear systems, and we're confronted by the complexities of an organic system that we can't predict.
I think you've hit it spot on there. I live with that conundrum every day, practically. Things look good. Things are going pretty well. We got a great harvest in from the garden, some happier days than I've seen in a long time, and yet I know that things are on very shaky ground, that my daughter and son could be in trouble, and my grandchild will certainly be in trouble. It's hard to live with that split.
Yes, it is. It's very hard. I've had students burst into tears in class over some of these conversations. But if you step back, this is the whole point of these books. If you step back and think, okay, wait a minute here. What else is going on? Yes, I get the picture, but what else has gone on? What else is going on? And you come up with a very different equation. Because if you are looking at a dynamic open system, as opposed to a fixed linear mechanical one, if a dynamic organic open system, it means there's all kinds of possibilities that are inherent in it. That's the nature of an open system. That's the nature of a dynamic growing system, is it isn't just one directional, right? And so if it's full of possibilities, why would we have to assume that the only likely outcome is that disaster scenario that keeps being thrown at us? Now, I think that the lessons of history, if you consider humans as capable of making choices that change the planet for the worse, they're also capable of making choices that change the planet for the better. And in fact, that's what history tells us over and over again. The tendency of our society is to see individuals as pointless, meaningless, and submerged in a mass of culture, right? You're one person, Alex. You can't do anything about anything, right? You get up in the morning, you got to change the world. By the time you've had your second cup of coffee and you've listened to the news, you know that anything you do won't make a difference, and so you sort of give up. And yet that is fundamentally ahistorical, because if you look at history, no, there's been no single action for good or ill that has been of any significance in the past that has been the result of the actions of a group. It's always been one person making a choice and opening up possibilities as a result of that choice that simply were not there before. And that's the gift.
You are listening to author Peter Denton talking about his new book, Close to Home. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. So in this book, Live Close to Home, once we make this philosophy our guide, does your book give readers a set of steps to get there?
I try to avoid it, the idea of it being a manual. It's never that simple. I think that attempting to do that would be inappropriate, and I think attempting to give that simple answer is simply wrong. That anyone who comes up with a single-factor solution to anything is missing the boat. It's not possible. And so a little how-to primer in my book, it would be meaningless and be laughable in itself. What I'm trying to do is to reorient people's perspectives. Perspective is an interesting word. And if you think about what a perspective is, it's the relationship, something in perspective puts everything in view into a particular relationship to the viewer. Okay? Now, what happens if you move? The same stuff is still there. That's not changed. What changes is the one thing you have control over, which is your place, your perspective on the stuff that's there. And so often we look at a situation and we are locked into what's happening. There are no possibilities. We can't do anything. This is an inevitability and all the rest of that kind of language. If you simply shift perspective, all of a sudden, there are possibilities there that simply weren't there before, because now you see things differently from a different vantage point. So if we consider our problems globally, I mean, that's not going to change. The levels of greenhouse gases continue to go up. The plastics in our oceans continue to increase. These things are there. You know, we still look at problems of what's happening with our food supply, with water, and all the rest of it. But if we consider that we have the capacity to make choices and change things in a different direction, all of a sudden there will be possibilities there that simply weren't there before. You are not powerless. The gift opens up possibilities that simply weren't there. And in fact, your interviewing me tonight is a gift. You're not paid for it. I couldn't have bought it. I can't reciprocate it. I can't invite you on my radio show and tell you, get you to talk about your book. You know, it's not possible. It's a gift. So everyone who listens to this program, as a consequence of your gift, will think things differently and see the world differently, maybe even read my book, which they never would have heard of otherwise, and that is entirely because of what you did.
Well, Peter Denton, we're going to have to wrap this up. Is there anything that I've missed that you would like to add?
Just that I think it's really important for people to read and to think. And those, again, seem like very simple tasks. But so few people these days are reading books. We far prefer to have some sort of skimpy thing coming in off the internet at us, and we don't actually sit and think through a book and think through what it includes and think for ourselves. So if you, as the host of the program, can encourage people to read books, there's lots of really good books out there. Reading creates a different perspective than simply going down to the bar or taking a walk by the ocean. It encourages other muscles and encourages us to think through what it is that we believe, what it is we are doing and why we're doing it, what our reasons are, what our values are. And I am convinced that we have the capacity as a species to think this problem through and come out the other side with answers, not simple ones, not easy ones, not quick ones, not painless ones, but answers. That's what we've always done as humans. That's what we can continue to do if we trust each other and trust that capacity to make a difference by the choices that we make. If we resign ourselves to our fate, we are essentially creating our own outcomes by doing nothing and just letting the systems continue to spiral the way they are. But those systems aren't inevitable. They're the product of the things that we in the past have chosen to create. So we have control over what we do. We have control over that future. And most especially, we have control over what we think in response to the problems we're confronted with.
From Manitoba, Canada, we've been talking with author, minister, military writer, and more, Dr. Peter Denton. And you can find some of his lectures on YouTube and his newest book, Live Close to Home, in the usual venues. I'll put links to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Peter, it's been a delight to hear from you. I think that you've changed my life a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. You changed mine.
I'm Alex Smith. That's it for this week. For two new projects, please check out my show blog or website at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for caring about our world.